Good afternoon, everyone. So let's go ahead and get started. So last class, we finished our 3 plus 1 decomposition of the Einstein equations. And now before, we're going to talk about the basically different ways of evolving the Einstein equations and also different ways of solving these constraint equations, the Hamilton momentum constraint that we need to solve to have initial data that satisfies the Einstein equations. But before that, for the first part of the class, I want to take a brief digression and talk about different types of partial differential equations. Because actually it turns out that even in this 3 plus 1 decomposed form of the Einstein equations, we don't quite have them in the form of sort of good mathematical PDEs that we can solve. So this is going to be just a very non-rigorous review of stuff you might have seen in like a mathematical physics course, but just going to emphasize sort of the physicist's definition of different kinds of partial differential equations. So I'm going to begin by giving sort of three canonical examples of partial differential equations that you see in physics that exemplify the three sort of main types of PDEs. So the first example is the wave equation. So this is all going to be sort of, for this example, just considering two variables. So time and space in this case. And this is our variable we're evolving. So that's just the wave equation in one dimension. And so this is sort of the canonical example of a hyperbolic PDE. The second example is the Laplace equation. So it looks almost the same except for the sign. Again, in two dimensions. And so this is sort of the canonical example of elliptic PDE. And the third example is the heat equation. And that's the canonical example of parabolic PDE. So you're sort of built in a little bit of the physics intuition here, where by defining the wave equation and the heat equation to be in terms of time and space, whereas this one to be in terms of two spatial dimensions. Though of course, if you're not taking a physics perspective, those are sort of interchangeable. But sort of the broad characteristics of these different types of equations are, for hyperbolic PDEs, we have initial value problems. So we specify some initial value at t equals 0, and then we can use that to evolve that forward. And hyperbolic PDEs, have this sort of notion of causality where information propagates at some finite speed. So if you want to figure out the value at some later time, that depends on some values at initial time, where this is sort of set by the characteristic propagation speed. For this wave equation, I've sort of implicitly set that wave speed to be 1. For elliptic PDEs, sort of the Brod-Stokes characteristics is, here there's no notion of time, and instead of solving initial value problems, we solve for boundary value problems, where, you know, for example, we have some charge distribution and we want to find the electric field by solving the Laplace equation. We set some boundary conditions, and then the, you know, value at any given point can depend on the values at other points. There's no sense of causality there. And then sort of the intermediate between hyperbolic and elliptic PDEs is these parabolic PDEs that have some notion of time, but in some sense, information can propagate infinitely fast. You know, if you start with a delta function and then let the heat equation spread out, it sort of, you know, instantaneously has a goes to a Gaussian with you know, support everywhere. So that's just sort of the intuition behind these different types of PDEs, you know, what kind of physics they would encode. And sort of in general, if we have some general second order linear PDE, then we sort of have all the different terms. So I'm going to write out that. So that's a general one where you have all these different terms. But it actually turns out that depending on these different coefficients, you can actually always put them sort of by an appropriate change of variables into one of these canonical forms plus some lower order terms. And by lower order terms here, I mean lower order in the derivatives. So that would be, we're only interested in the leading order terms are the ones that are all are second derivatives. So if this quantity is greater than zero, I'm asserting that you can then by definition it's hyperbolic, and then you can put it in the form of the wave equation plus some lower order terms by an appropriate change of variables. And then same thing, if this quantity is zero, that's the intermediate case where it's parabolic. And then you just have one variable where you have the second derivatives and then all lower order terms. And then if this quantity is less than zero, that's the elliptic case. And these would be sort of some new variable that would be a So was there a question?
Yeah, I couldn't, like, I didn't know what is LOT.
Oh, just lower order terms. Yeah. So that's for one variable for second order PDEs. Now let's consider something slightly different, which I'll show is sort of equivalent to this, which is to consider some general n-dimensional vector u, which encodes n different variables. And then we'll consider this first order linear PDE. So here, u we're considering, you know, n different variables. We have PDEs for each component, and then here A and B would be matrices that act on these vectors. So we have a time derivative. This matrix sits in front of the partial of the space derivative, and then we have some just matrix acting just on U. So then it turns out you can basically determine the character of this linear partial differential equation just by looking at the spectral decomposition of just A. So in fact, you can ignore the B term, basically, because we're interested in the high frequency limit, or that is when we're considering very short wavelengths in which this term will dominate. So what I mean by that, hopefully become a bit more clear in a second. But so now to, there are actually kind of different degrees of hyperbolicity. So if we look at this vector A in particular, look at its eigenvalues and eigenvectors, if A has all real eigenvectors, then we're going to say that this equation here is weakly hyperbolic. And if, in addition to this, we also have a complete set of eigenvectors. Then we're going to say that this equation star is strongly hyperbolic. And so it turns out this that strong hyperbolicity for this case is actually equivalent to this to something called well-posedness, which rough yes question.
What do we mean by complete set of eigenvectors?
So like if this is if n is like a sorry if u is a n-dimensional vector, then we would want n, so then A would be an n by n matrix. We want n eigenvectors.
Like you mean that we don't have like visionary instincts, right?
Yeah, exactly. So if you have some degeneracy and you don't have a complete set of eigenvectors, then this would not, you won't have strong hyperbolicity. Yeah.
It could be real or not real, we don't care. Right? Because when you mentioned that, you know, when we wanted to like look for the weakly hyperbolicity, we want all of them to be real, but it could be like imaginary or anything.
So I'm saying, if you have this, then you're weakly hyperbolic. If you have this, and in addition to this, then you're strongly hyperbolic. Yeah. So. Yeah. So strong hyperbolicity turns out to be equivalent to something called well-posedness, which roughly means that if you make a basically that the solution you get at some later time depends continuously on your initial conditions, that you can't make sort of make an arbitrarily small change to your initial conditions and then get your solution at some later time to be arbitrarily large distance away from your original solution.
So how do you know this? If A is all real eigenvectors?
This is my, basically I'm defining this to mean strongly hyperbolic.
Why not define it like it's weakly parabolic or something? I don't know.
Like, what does weakly hyperbolic mean?
So in a second we'll show that if we, you know, for example, look at the wave equation, or any equation that can be put in the same form as the wave equation plus some lower terms, then in fact it is strongly hyperbolic. And if you take something, then we'll basically show that if you have something that's not strongly hyperbolic, it's elliptic or weakly hyperbolic, then you won't have a quote-unquote well-posed initial value problem. That's where we're going here.
Okay.
Yeah, so so sort of technically by well-posedness, I mean the following. So you have some solution at some time t, and you look at its value in some norm. And that should sort of be bounded by the initial, some norm of the initial conditions up to some constant. And we'll even allow for exponential growth. But the key point is that this k and this alpha, they can be whatever values you want them to be, but they can't depend on your initial conditions. So they should be independent of your initial conditions. So in particular, we can, you know, you can see if I just even ignore this term, I could get some ODEs. And I could choose B, you know, to have negative eigenvalues, and then you get some things that are exponentially growing in time. That's fine. That's still well posed. I mean, there are plenty of physical systems that are unstable in that sense. So we're allowing for this exponential growth, but these shouldn't depend on the initial conditions, or basically for the general case, you know, if we make a perturbation at some, you know, different wavelengths, we don't want this these solutions to diverge arbitrarily fast. Yes?
Aren't k and alpha real parameters?
Yeah.
Or could it be like...
Yeah, so this is some norm that would presumably give you a real value.
It's just for the exponential. Like, they could it be oscillatory? Could alpha be imaginary? That's what I...
Well, yeah, I mean, we're just crying this to be less than or equal to this. So this, I mean, so it's an inequality, or,
okay.
Right? So.
Okay, yeah, we don't really care.
I don't really care about the oscillations.
Okay, I see.
Yeah. Okay, so now, so yeah, my claim is that actually this strong hyperbolicity is equivalent to this well-posedness. So let's begin by looking at some examples.
Okay.
Something like a complex thing that their multiplication gives a real thing?
The t changes, so it won't stay real.
Right.
Yeah, so first let's look at the wave equation. So if we want to put the wave equation into this first order form, we can do that the following way. So we just introduce this vector u. Use first component is just u, and then second component would be the first time derivative of u, and the third component would be the first spatial derivative of u. And then we can rewrite our wave equation in this form. So this is the A matrix, and that's the B one. And we can just to check that this makes sense. So This first equation is just saying that, you know, the evolution of u is just given by this second component, which makes sense because we defined it that way, right? Then if we look at what we get for sort of the second line of this equation, it's going to be that the first time derivative of the second component, which would be the second time derivative of u, is going to be it's going to be equal to the partial derivative, the spatial derivative of the third component of this one. So that'll just give us, you know, second time derivative of u, not the vector, is equal to the second space derivative of u. And then the third line will basically give us that ut ux is equal to ux ut of u. So any questions about that? So now if we look at the spectral decomposition of this matrix, I can sort of do it very quickly. And you get that the eigenvalues are going to be 0 and then plus or minus 1. And then the eigenvectors are going to be 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, and 0, 1, minus 1. So you can, so sort of physically, this kind of makes sense. So the zero eigenvalue is basically just the one that's, you know, keeping our constraint that, you know, we introduce this new variable is basically the partial time derivative of u. But then the sort of physical propagation is, you know, we have the characteristics that propagate at plus or minus 1, and they sort of correspond to the, you know, ut minus, basically to right moving and left moving wave solutions, which we know from, you know, the general solution of the wave equation. We'll have, you know, two characteristics, left moving and right moving, and they'll propagate at, you know, the wave speed, which I've set to 1. So indeed, you know, this equation is strongly hyperbolic by this definition here. So any questions?
Can you repeat exactly why you wrote the DTU again like this in the matrices?
So this is just showing that. So before I started with this second order partial differential equation of one variable, but now we're going to introduce our definitions for general, you know, in this what's called first order form. But this just shows that you can rewrite those second-order partial differential equations in this first-order form, and then just look at this matrix to sort of figure out all the character of your equations. But did you have questions about how?
Yeah, but where the numbers come from?
Yeah. So basically the sort of first line of the equation is just going to be that, you know, partial t of just this u is equal to this second column, which is by that's basically the constraint that we introduced here.
Right.
The actual wave equation will be the second line here, right, which just says I take another time derivative here. I have two time derivatives of u, and then I'm going to take a time derivative of my last element, which is a space derivative of my last element, which means I have two space derivatives on u. So that's the wave equation part. And then again, for the bottom one, it's, you know, you're taking a time derivative and a spatial derivative. And then, you know, here you're taking the spatial derivative of the time derivative. So, yeah. So So that's the wave equation. If we can repeat this for the Laplace equation, and we'll get almost the same thing up to a sign in our A matrix. So this is for Laplace. So we just flip this sign here. But of course, when you make that one flip of the sign, then we get complex eigenvalues. So then our eigenvalues are 0 and then plus or minus I. And what this means is that we're actually going to have solutions. If you have some solution with wavelength 1 over omega, then that's actually going to blow up exponentially, like e to the omega t. And notice there's no constraint on how large you can make omega. This is saying if you basically choose some initial data, that has wavelengths at arbitrarily small values, then it'll blow up arbitrarily fast, right? So in some sense, this is an example of not having a well-posed initial value problem. And in some sense, I would say, this doesn't give you a predictive theory in the sense that, if you specify your initial conditions to 20 digits, then you change the 21st digit, you can get a completely different solution. So your theory doesn't really have any predictive power as an initial data, as a initial value problem. So that's sort of why you can't pretend elliptic equations are hyperbolic and evolve them the same way.
So when you say t here, do you mean like the equation is dt squared plus dx squared? Like you're using a Euclidean signature-ish?
Yeah. So if we just took this Laplace equation, like say written this way, so we just pretended.
What? Laplace equation is dx squared plus dy.
Yeah. So I'm just saying if we pretended. Okay. So that's kind of the physics intuition, and it makes sense because basically, you shouldn't, like, if you have hyperbolic equations, they sort of involve time. That's the physicist's perspective. But if let's just say you're a mathematician. Why can't I just call y t and then treat it this way? So that's sort of, I mean, you can certainly put it in the same form that we have up there. But then, yeah, it has this problem that it's not even weakly hyperbolic.
So can you explain why this is not well posed again? Because we allow the exponential like behavior in this definition, but is it like
but
it depends on the initial?
Yeah, exactly. So for example, if you had some term in B that gave you exponential growth, you could bound that because you know what B is, right? But this is saying I can just basically choose my, if I choose some initial condition that has a wavelength of 1 over omega, then it's going to blow up like this, right? And so I can choose that to be whatever value I want. Yeah, and so then finally, let's look at the sort of marginal case where we don't have strong hyperbolicity, but we do have weak hyperbolicity. So let me give you an example of that. So just two variables, u and v. So this is an example here where know, if we look at the decomposition of this matrix, it just has one eigenvalue. One of multiplicity two. And the one eigenvector is just given by that. But we don't have a complete set of eigenvectors. So in this case, you don't get sort of exponential frequency dependent blowout, but instead you'll actually get linear frequency dependent blowout. So you can check that you get solutions of the following form. So again, you're not blowing up exponentially, you're just oscillating. But this coefficient here, in this case, depends linearly on the frequency. So again, you know, you can make the frequency arbitrarily large by choosing initial data at that spatial wavelength, and then it'll blow up linearly in time for this particular case. So again, this sort of shows that you need strong hyperbolicity to have well posedness.
How did you solve this?
Yeah, well, I mean, you can just check that this works, but there's kind of a general way to construct these solutions that blow up by looking at the generalized eigenvectors. So I don't know if you're familiar with that, but like if you have, you know, say you have, if you don't have a complete set of eigenvectors, then you'll have like a generalized eigenvector that is something such that you know, if you apply this, well, in general, if you apply this, you know, this A matrix minus the eigenvector times the identity, if you apply that n times, yeah, you don't get zero. But then if you apply it n plus one times, then you do get zero. And so for this case, it's m is just one. So it's not, and then based on that, you can, in general, construct these solutions that have like a frequency dependent growth.
So for solving this, you apply more and more A minus lambda I's until you can find a complete set of eigenvectors?
So you don't have a complete set of eigenvectors, but this is called a generalized eigenvector.
Uh-huh. So instead of finding eigenvectors, you find a generalized set of eigenvectors?
Yeah. So basically, if you have a solution of this if you have this vector, you can use it to construct these solutions that have this frequency dependent growth. And so here m is one, and you have something that blows up linearly in time. And in general, if you have these, you know, if you have this degeneracy and m generalized eigenvector, then you'll get blow up like t to the m. So you can get, you know.
People just looking at the eigenvalues realize that it's going to blow up before, I mean, because now you're just saying you solved it and you saw that, okay, it's blowing up. But here, how did you realize that it's blowing up because you have
the
eigenvalues?
Yeah, so here it's easy because, you know, basically we're saying, you know, we have, so just ignore the B part, we have something like this, right? So let's plug in a solution of this form, right? And then we get, you know, I omega here. And then say we have an eigenvalue solution, then we're going to get Right. So then as long as K, you know, solves this, then we get a solution of this form, right?
Huh.
And so the fact that this is imaginary means that...
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but here it's a little more complicated to get this linear dependence on time, yeah.
Because you don't have imaginary eigenvalues, but you don't have a complete set of eigenvectors. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, so this degree of freedom will just, you know, oscillate like a wave, but then you have these other solutions that blow up polynomial in time.
So even though this is also hyperbolic, right?
This is weakly hyperbolic, but not strongly hyperbolic, and therefore it's not well posed.
So you define strongly hyperbolic as, what is exactly the definition? The definition is that you have a complete set of eigenvectors, and all the eigenvalues are.
Yeah. So strong hyperbolic is all the eigenvalues are real, and you have a complete set of eigenvectors. Yep. And so it has all the eigenvalues are real, so it's weakly hyperbolic, but we don't have a complete set, so it's not strongly hyperbolic. Yeah. So the general sort of message of all this discussion is that you need a well-posed initial value problem to have a predictive theory. And something you'll find is that, you know, for example, a lot of times in effective field theories, you'll have some truncation of a theory, and you'll, you know, write down some action that's truncated in some terms, and then we actually, you know, write down the equations of motion for that. You know, it won't be, it won't give you a well-posed initial value problem. And in some sense, you know, what that's telling you is you can't just take those equations of motion verbatim and use them to make predictions. You need some extra information about, you know, how to handle the small wavelength behavior to be able to, you know, have a predictive theory out of that. Yeah, so any questions about that before we go back to talking about the Einstein equations? All right, so it actually turns out that the ADM evolution equations we wrote down at the end of last class are actually not strongly hyperbolic or are well posed. So there's a couple of different ways to handle that. So one of them is to look at a sort of modified version of the ADM equations where you introduce some new variables that sort of control the, conformal metric degrees of freedom and so on, and derive what are called the BSSN equations, and those actually do give you a well-posed initial value problem. And those are in terms of these, again, like sort of the space-time decomposition and then an extra conformal decomposition of those. So you'll work that out in one of the tutorials soon. But today, for the rest of the class, I'm going to talk about a different well-posed initial value formulation of the Einstein equations that actually doesn't make use of this 3 plus 1 decomposition. And that's called the generalized harmonic formulation of the Einstein equations.
Sorry, I have a question about this Laplace thing. Because I guess I'm confused by, are you saying that it doesn't have a well post? It's not a well, because Laplace is, it is like.
Yeah, so it has a sort of well-defined boundary value problem. So for example, you know, you could, you know, take some, you know, some like region and X and Y coordinates, specify some boundary data on this, and then solve for the solution in the interior.
Like, but if you only specify like X, then...
Yeah, but sort of if you try to treat it like an initial value problem and say, aha, I'm just gonna specify some data here and then like try to evolve it there, then that doesn't make sense physically. So we'll actually talk about, so like it turns out the constraint equations are of this elliptic form, and we're gonna probably next class do some work to kind of put them in the form of essentially the Laplace equation. And there, you know, you construct initial data and it makes physical sense, but you don't treat it as like an evolution equation, you treat it as like a boundary value problem. Yeah, so I mean, there's physics in all these equations. So it's not like, if it's not hyperbolic, it doesn't have any physics in it. But it is just the way you know, the physics that's in there is different from this notion of time and causality. Okay. All right, so we're going to talk about the generalized harmonic formulation of the Einstein equations. So last class, we talked about how we could sort of control our coordinate or gauge degrees of freedom by specifying the lapse and shift. But here we're going to use a different way of setting our coordinate degrees of freedom. And we're going to do that by the following. We're going to require the box. That is the two covariant derivatives of our coordinates themselves to be equal to some source functions HA, which we're going to basically specify our gauge degrees of freedom. So in the most simplest case, we could set these to zero, for example, and we'd have what's called harmonic coordinates. So we'll return to that in a second. But you know, as you can see, these are not, this is not really a vector, because it's, you know, we're explicitly, it's not a covariant vector. We're explicitly defining it in terms of our coordinates and using it to fix our coordinate degrees of freedom. So really, you should think of, you know, I have, you know, four equations here, you know, one for each of the different coordinates. And so the main idea of this generalized harmonic formation is we're actually going to promote this HA into an evolution equation itself. And we're going to use this to put the Einstein equations into a nice form that's sort of manifestly hyperbolic, that's sort of manifestly like the wave equation. All right, so let's start with the Einstein equations in trace reverse form. And then let's note that when we're writing out this Ricci tensor, we can actually write it in the following way. All right, so here I'm just mean some arbitrary function of the metric and its first derivatives, because I'm only going to be interested in the second derivatives of the metric. But so here I have something that's sort of manifestly like a wave operator operating on the metric. But then here I'm introducing this sort of new equation, this new variable gamma. And by gamma, I basically mean the contraction of the Christoffel symbol. So you just contract the two indices of the Christoffel symbol, and then, and well, let's write it upper indices, it'll be more clear. Right, so you know, if you take a derivative of this, you're going to get some. So you know, Christoffel symbols have first derivatives of the metric, and then if we take a derivative of this, we'll get some second derivatives of the metric, and we can actually write all of the other second derivative metric terms in this following form. And
do you also use the metric to lower the gammas?
Yeah. So this one with the lower would just be literally take this thing and then use the metric to lower it. Yeah. And so you know, you can very quickly check that this is actually equal to negative of the source functions as I defined it this way.
Why was RAB like that? How did you, why is it like plus a function of GAB? And where did that come from?
Yeah, this is just taking the definition of RAB. So I'll write out all the equations in this in here in a second. But yeah, basically there'll be some, like when you write out the Ricci tensor in terms of the metric, you'll have some, you know, you have some Christoffel symbols contracted with itself, and you'll have some like derivatives of the Christoffel symbols. And so basically I'm saying what we really care about is just the, you know, and what the principal part of the equations will be termed about is the highest derivative. So these are lower order terms we don't need to worry about.
Why don't we worry about them at all?
Hmm?
Why do we only want the highest orders of derivatives?
It
looks like a hyperbolic thing later, but why?
I mean, so definitely you need to keep them to have the correct equations, but in order to determine the character of the equations, basically you only care about the higher order terms because, you know, when you go to this first order form by you know, reducing from the second order form, basically the matrix A will just depend on the highest derivative terms, and the other ones will go to the sort of the B part, and so that it won't change the character of the equations what the lower order terms are doing.
But when you had that general linear PDE equation, it mattered that, oh, it didn't matter, right?
Yeah, so we can basically use the fact that if we require the coordinates to satisfy this, then we can swap out these terms for these HA terms. And so if we do that, we arrive at the generalized harmonic equations. All right, so basically before we made the swap, we would have had all the h's with just this gamma a and a minus sign. But then we are using this constraint, and then we make the substitution. And now we basically gotten rid of all our problematic higher order terms for the metric, and we're basically left with just this one. That's the principal part. And this is sort of manifestly just the coordinate wave operator acting on each component of the metric. So then we know it's sort of in this manifestly hyperbolic form. Basically, as long as our metric has a single time-like direction, they have a theorem to guarantee this will be hyperbolic. So the idea is we can evolve the metric according to this, but now we need to also specify how these source functions are going to evolve. So in the most general case, we just can specify sort of any evolution operator for H as long as it's hyperbolic, and use that to evolve along with our Einstein equations. But in reality, it turns out most of the time you make some pretty simple choices for H, so you don't actually have to evolve them as well. So sort of the simplest choice, or sorry, a simple choice with H would just be you basically require H to be some function of the metric, and perhaps its time derivatives as well. Just some function of the metric, and so then you don't have to evolve it as well. And you can see that we have first derivatives of H. So if we have first derivatives of this, those will still be lower order terms, right? And the absolute simplest thing we could do is just choose this FA to be zero. And that's what's called harmonic coordinates. For the obvious reason that we're basically requiring the coordinates to satisfy this wave equation.
Why is there a need to choose any other, when do you want to choose any other function for the source?
Here, for example, maybe we're thinking of merging two black holes or something like that, or some other very extreme situation, and one particular gauge might not have the desired properties we want. So for example, in terms of developing coordinate singularities or things like that, right? So in particular, for merging black holes, it was found that you can do it in a harmonic gauge, but the black holes actually get very distorted, and it's not a particularly good gauge for doing that. And actually requiring something like requiring the source functions to satisfy something like a damped wave equation is actually better than this simple harmonic choice. Basically different choices can be made on the problem, but they'll all sort of be guaranteed to be hyperbolic, but they might be better or worse properties for their particular problem.
If you choose H to be a function of del G, then it will have higher order, it will contribute to higher order terms, right?
So if you choose this to be explicitly a function of the derivatives of the metric, then you're not guaranteed to have a well-posed system, because then basically you might be changing these might become non-lower order terms, like principal terms. Yeah. So you can imagine that if you know, I have a solution for all time. I have some four-dimensional manifold with the whole solution. I could always just take the sort. I could just always compute what box of those coordinates are, and then set the source functions to be that, right? So if I sort of know what solution I'm going to get ahead of time, like you can always do it this way. So in that sense, it's pretty general, but that may not be true.
Sorry, did you open up that function f here in the story quiz?
No. You can put it out there if you want. This f and that f are not the same.
No. And then you
open
f here in the general.
Oh yeah. So those are these extra terms. So basically, yeah, this equation with h going to minus gamma would be that one there. And then I think I multiply by a factor of two or something.
And when you're saying ha is a function of gab, is it just a function of gab or its derivatives as well?
Yeah, like we're just saying. You don't want it to be a function of the derivatives, or you are not guaranteed to be hyperbolic. Because you have first derivatives of h here. So if you have second derivatives of the metric, then it can mess that up. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So you know, sort of the idea here is that your evolution equations are going to be the metric, its first derivative, and then in the general case, the source functions and its first derivative. Though, like I said, in general, or for many specific cases, you just don't explicitly evolve these and just use some function. But now we, you know, one issue you might raise is, we're initially, you know, setting these source functions to be box of the coordinates, but then when we evolve this way, how are we guaranteed that, you know, if we take our solution later at the time, take the box of those coordinates on that later time, that it'll be equal to the source functions that we're evolving with here. So this is sort of equivalent to the question we were discussing last time. If you satisfy some constraints at t equals zero, how do you know that you'll satisfy them later? So to keep track of the evolution of the constraints.
Sorry, I'm just asking you to repeat some stuff. What is LH equal to zero? What is that supposed to represent?
I'm just saying in the general case, you could just specify some arbitrary evolution equation for HA. I don't know, like also give it a wave-like equation or something like that.
You can define the evolution of H yourself.
Yeah, because it's basically encoding your gauge degrees of freedom. So you can.
But so if you can do that, and if someone says, I want my H to have derivatives of G, you're saying, so it should, in that particular choice, for that particular choice of H, it should also be solvable, but your equation changes, it could change nature, because you would have second derivatives of G.
Can you just choose,
so that someone might say, I want to choose an H that has a second derivative of G, because I want to. And why would you say, no, you can't do this? I know you're saying the nature changes, but I'm just saying.
If you have some arbitrary solution for all time, you can always just compute h of a for that, right? And but what I'm saying is, if you want a well-posed initial value problem, where you specify some initial conditions and then you require that if I make an arbitrarily small change to that initial condition, it's not going to take me arbitrarily far away from my equation, then you can specify any sort of hyperbolic equation for h of a. Like you could require it to satisfy a wave equation itself or something like that. And so that's basically, you know, that's not changing the physics, that's just changing your coordinate choices. It's the same way for like the 3+1 decomposition, I said that, you know, there's no implied, there's no equations for the lapse and shift. You could choose those yourself. So that would be sort of the equivalent here. But yeah, in practice, you know, these tend to be the ones that get used. And, you know, if you could, I mean, you could set, you could also just set f of a to some arbitrary function of space, right? That'd be fine too.
But I think what you're saying is that you can choose whatever function you want, but if you want your answer to converge, you choose these.
But yeah, if you want it to be well posed, yeah. So if you, you know, put some second derivatives here, or sorry, you put some first derivatives of the metric here, then you need to worry about this problem where if you make some small change at short wavelengths, it'll blow up. Yep.
I'm now confused about this gauge fixing thing, because in general, if you say that h is a gauge freedom, degree of freedom, so you should treat h as a function of like your coordinates, right? Like you can't just say I want my h to be a function of my metric.
Yeah, well, yeah. So, I mean, yeah, if you want, you can have the coordinates here too. That's fine.
As in, like, I feel like because the gauge degree of freedom is that you can choose that h to be any function of space time. But why are you justified to choose that as a function of metric? Like, because that would be like you're implicitly already setting up a differential equation for the metric, right? Because you have metric. Like you have derivative metric and metric. Like.
Yeah. So that's basically going to be the constraint, right? You're saying that this implies some constraint on the evolution of the metric. I think that's where we're going to sort of show that if you initially satisfy that constraint, then you'll satisfy it later times.
So if I say h is sick, is dependent on the first derivative of the metric, does that mean like there I'm overdetermining what the metric is, or?
No. So where I started going is, you know, this sort of implies a constraint, right? So you tell me what h of a is, you know, you can evolve to some time, I can compute what box xa is, right, just from the metric, and then I can check that it's equal to h of a, and you're saying after just, you know, evolving with this and, you know, and using this thing to plug in those, and you're saying, how do I know at some later time that I'll still satisfy this constraint? Isn't it over-constrained? Is that basically your question?
I guess that.
Okay, so that's exactly where we're going. So maybe if it's still not clear, ask me after that. Well, yeah, but we want to know exactly how these constraints evolve with time. Right, so let me call CA basically our constraint, that H of A is equal to box of XA. And so, you know, to sort of satisfy the Einstein equations, we want this to be zero for all time. So if we just recall how we you know, derive these equations, we just did it by, you know, switching out HA for minus box of the coordinate, or for box of the coordinates, or the other way around, rather. So if we don't necessarily assume that this constraint is satisfied, then we'll get some extra terms on the right-hand side. And it'll be, you know, exactly the ones we switched out. So now let's say we're sort of off shell. So we have these extra constraint violation there. Then we want to drive how this evolves with time. So if we, you know, project this equation with, you know, NA and B, like we did last time, or with one spatial operator and one time-like one, basically we get the Hamiltonian and momentum constraints. So, you know, in fact, the requirement that so basically the time derivative of these constraints being zero is equivalent to the constraint equations. So if we start with you know, initial data for our metric and matter that satisfy these Hamiltonian mid constraints, you know, then we set these, you know, source functions to be, you know, equal to box of the coordinates at the initial time, we'll at least have that the first time derivative is zero. But now we need to check how it evolves with time. So we can sort of take the trace of this guy and subtract 1f GAB times that. So if we do that, we get the following. All right, so then we can take the divergence of both sides. So then we'll get zero for this one by what? Bianchi identity, yes. And then take the divergence of this one and we'll get zero by what? Conservation of stress energy, yeah. So then we'll just have divergence of this is equal to zero. So it was by Bianchi plus stress energy conservation. And then basically if we you know, use the definition of the Riemann tensor to switch some of these covariant derivatives, a little bit of algebra, we can arrive at the following. So this is the evolution of constraints that we have. So we can see that actually it itself satisfies some wave equation, but then with this you know, source term here in terms of the Ricci tensor. So that way we know that if we start with initial data where it's zero and it's first time turned to zero, the source will be zero, and then we're actually guaranteed to have that it's zero for all time.
Sorry, the divergence of RAU minus RGAB, you said it's zero because of the Bianchi identity?
Yeah, this is the Einstein tensor, right?
Okay. Right.
So maybe just quick remark, and then let you go, is that, this basically tells you that if you exactly satisfy the constraints and you solve with the exact equations, then your constraints will be zero for all time. So actually this is, if for example you're doing a numerical simulation, this is a very non-trivial check that you're doing the right thing, is to basically check that the norm of these constraints is converging to zero as you increase the resolution. Basically, if you do anything wrong, if you are not evolving with the right equations, if you're coupling it to some matter that doesn't obey energy conservation, if you're doing any of those things, then you'll see that the constraints won't converge to zero. However, something you might see is that they can grow exponentially in time. The exponential growth will be frequency dependent. It's not like you have an ill-posed system, but they can still grow exponentially in time, and that can cause problems with getting a accurate solution for a long time. So that was kind of one of the problems that people struggle with at the very beginning when they were trying to get the binary black hole problem to work. And it actually turns out the solution to that was to change the behavior of this equation when you don't exactly satisfy the constraints by adding extra terms to it that are proportional to constraints, basically to change the behavior of the constraints when they're not exactly satisfied. So it actually turns out if you add I won't write it down in the interest of time, but you can add some function of the constraints to the generalized harmonic equations, and then try to basically put this into the form of a damped wave equation. So let me go ahead and end there since we're over time, and stop and ask if you have any questions.
In which cases does the stress energy conservation not hold true? Are there cases when the stress energy conservation does not hold?
When I was giving that example, I meant more that's like a non-trivial check that you're evolving the matter the right way. If you satisfy the Einstein equations, then it has to hold, right? Because in some sense, the Einstein equations say the Einstein tensor is equal to the stress and energy tensor up to some constant. And so the Bianchi identity will be sort of satisfied by construction. So you're not going to satisfy the Einstein equations if it's coupled to some matter that doesn't obey the stress energy conservation. Okay, well, let me end here, and I'll stick around for a few minutes if there are any more questions. Okay.